Sergeant Newman, Reel 7. You were saying that you had the nightmares and that you had treatment with gas for that.
Yeah, I had this gas treatment.
Do you know what sort of gas it was?
No. No idea at all.
Mm. And you're saying that it's beginning to come back.
Yeah, so this has come back recently when I was in hospital this last time with this heap.
Yeah.
I was, they were pumping so many drugs into me.
Yes.
That I was hallucinating. So all my past life, army, prison of war camp, everything, came back. Oh. I didn't know my own family.
Yeah.
And I was telling them some weird and wonderful tales that was taking place in hospital. I was attending funerals, I was attending weddings. I had rats underneath my bed, I had things dropping off the ceiling on the top of me. That's really, really hallucinating.
Yeah.
I was.
But before then you didn't have any trouble after the...
Well, I don't know. I had mild attacks.
Mild attacks?
Yeah, which I could overcome by Valium.
Right.
But you can't get Valium now, you see.
Yeah.
They took it off the market, didn't they? Well, then I used to get tablets from Germany. Friends going over to Germany because they got an equivalent to Valium in Germany. So I was controlling it all the way along the line. And I'll tell you, it wasn't until I landed up in hospital that the past came back.
Mm.
And I haven't really back to normal yet.
Mm.
I mean, half the time I sleep on here.
Yeah.
Because if I go to bed, I'll get a reoccurrence. Mm. They call me the great escapee in the hospital. I was always missing.
Oh.
While I was under this hallucination, you see.
Mm.
I was galloping across fields with Germans after me. I was galloping across fields with nurses after me. I was drowning. I was in the morgue. And I fell off the slab in the morgue. You name it and it happened to me. And then, yeah.
You'd been a soldier twice, hadn't you? Both before the war and in the
war.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
And you're having these flashbacks because of the...
Yes, I've had the flashbacks.
Yeah.
But they're controllable.
Yeah.
Well, then I got a job in the civil service.
Yes, I was going to ask you whether it was difficult to readjust to being a civilian after being in the army, or whether you found that easy coming back.
I thought I'd readjusted.
Yeah.
But then I'd... There is things, certain instances that can occur where I find that I haven't adjusted really. It's there, in the subconscious, it's there. And certain things will bring it out. But a normal life doesn't bring it out. It was the drugs I was taking that brought it out. You see?
What sort of job did you do for the civil service when you got back?
Well, I had one or two jobs which I couldn't keep. Because I was drinking heavily. And then I decided that I was becoming a teetotaler, of which I've been a teetotaler for about 30-odd years now. And I got a job at the Air Force Station here, which suited me fine. I never had a problem. In fact, that bit on the wall there, small one at the bottom, that's...
Yes.
I was mentioned in the Queen's Birthday Honours list twice. I received two commendations while I was at the Air Force. And I established myself very well. I never had a problem.
I think you were saying earlier on that you were involved in running a camp for German prisoners.
Oh, yes. Well, when I got the first job I had, and for by the way, I came home to a 5-year-old son who had never seen me. So now I had to bond with a 5-year-old son.
Become a father.
Hmm?
Become a father.
Hmm. Well, that wasn't a problem. I must have gone about it the right way.
Mm.
Because I'm the bee's knees to him. Mm. There's nobody like his dad. And since I've had this problem, that's him been on the phone twice today.
Yes.
Wants to know if I'm all right. And, you know, all that. Couldn't wish for a better son.
Mm.
So that was a problem for a start. Well, and I went to apply for a job at the War Agricultural Committee, working under prison camps. And my first job was at Allington, near Grantham. And half the camp there was Italian prisoners and German. Now, I cannot stand Italian prisoners, or Italians in any case, as far as I'm concerned. I think they're idlers, idle, cocky, self-centred. And my first job was to take them out, potato setting, 30 men, Italian. And there was a slight drizzle of rain on. And I got them started in the field, sitting in the days. Of course, we had the English workmen, farm workers there. They never complained. This Italian came up to me. He was a junior officer. And he said, "Me no work." I said, "No." "No, no, no." I said, "Why?" "It's raining." I said, "Well, that's hard lines on you, boy. You will work." Well, he argued with me, but I got him back at work. But about half an hour later, he was missing, and I knew where he was. I went to the lorry, and he's asleep in the back of the lorry. So I climbed in the back, and I grabbed him, and I bodily threw him over the tailboard of the lorry onto the ground. I said, "You'll work. That's it. I know what it's like." So he must have reported me, because I went to work the next morning, called me in the office. I said, "We've had a complaint." I said, "Yeah, oh yeah, what it?" I said, "This Italian complained that I bodily threw him out of the lorry. Is that right?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Why?" I said, "They're here to work." I said, "I've been incarcerated in Germany for all them years. I had to work. If I didn't work, I got shot. Think yourself bloody lucky that I only threw him out the back of the lorry." I said, "Well, we don't think you like Italians." I said, "I hate them." I said, "How about Germans?" I said, "Yes, I can cope with Germans, because I said I speak their language." So now they put me on the other side of the camp, on Germans. Then they moved me to just outside of Grantham, on the High Dyke. There was a small prisoner of war camp there. I was the in charge of that. Then right out of the blue, and I was living at Thistleton then, at South Witham. Right out of the blue, they sent for me and said, "How would you like to take over a bigger prisoner of war camp?" I said, "Where?" They said, "Woolfox, which is just here." I said, "That'll suit me fine." They were all SS prisoners.
How did you get on with them?
Wonderful. Wonderful. Mind you, they treated me well. They knew I'd been in their hands. They knew the treatment I got. And so I gave them the best treatment we could. And the one instance which endeared me to them, or them to me, we got a batch of 100 in from America. And of course, when they arrived here, they'd got all the knick-knacks that they'd bought in America, you know, like wallets and watches and all this. And the captain in charge of the military up there, he only had about 10 or 15 men. He got them on parade when they arrived. And out of curiosity, I walked down to see what was happening with them, you see. And they were confiscating all their personal belongings. Wallets, cigarettes, watches. Captain Gould. So I went up to him and I said, "Captain, you know you're breaking the law." He said, "What do you mean breaking the law?" I said, "You cannot confiscate personal belongings off them prisoners." "Who says so?" I said, "The Geneva Convention says so." "What do you know about the Geneva Convention?" I said, "I can quote the Geneva Convention to you forward, backwards, any way you like. What you're supposed to do, what you're not supposed to do, and what on them is, you cannot confiscate them people's personal belongings." He wouldn't believe me. I said, "Well, I'm sorry. I still have to report you to higher authority." I said, "Because I'm not having it. How about you get them all back in?" Now, the prisoners saw this, you see, and they thought the world of me. Yeah. They'd do anything for me. They were. And then I used to, at birthday parties or Christmas parties, I used to bring a lorry load down to my house in South Witham, give them a roaring party over Christmas and Boxing Day, all in turn. And in the finish, I managed to get half of the occupants, the population of South Witham, doing the same. I was bringing them down by the lorry load, and they were giving them Christmas parties and birthday parties. And I was very strict on their employment, because I was employed on these farms scattered all around Rutland and Lincolnshire and all around there. And my, part of my job was to supervise, see, every so often I had to go out to these farmers and find out what was happening. And if there was any complaints from the prisoners, they had to bring them to me. Well, of course, there was like thousands of complaints.
What sort of things were they complaining
about? Well, there was farmers threatening to shoot them, threatening to beat them. Even had one farmer with a stock whip who started whipping them to make them go work faster. Another one was they wouldn't allow Toft near Bourne. He wouldn't allow them to sit down and have the meal at lunchtime. It was work trying to work them right through the day. And so I went across to see him. I went with him. And then on midday, I said, okay, because he was employed somewhere, about five or six of his own men. They worked through, they just went, well, naturally, because they could get their food from the wives. They could cook it for them and bring it out to them. And this fellow said to me, they said, what are you doing? I said, they're having their dinner. I said, you'll catch it. I said, who? I said, the boss. I said, okay, I ain't bothered. I can still see him now coming across the field in his Austin 16, bouncing across the field. What's the meaning of this, ganger? I said, the meaning of what? He said, not allowed to have a stop for midday meal on this place. I said, you may not, your blokes may not, but these prisoners are allowed their meal at midday. End of story. I said, I'll report you to the war. I said, do that. When it gone, I went straight to the telephone and I phoned Seaford. I told him, I said, withdraw his labour immediately. So I phoned through to Wolfock there, to one of my drivers. I said, bring a lorry out, pick these blokes up. And within an hour, they were back getting into the camp there. No farmer, he couldn't believe this. He said, I want them there tomorrow. I said, that's debatable. So when I brought them back, I phoned Sleaford and said, use your discretion. Withdraw his labour altogether, if you think of it. So I called round the next day, I went, and he was waiting for him. I said, you're blacklisted. From now on, you'll get no more prisoners. But that was just one. I had quite a few farmers that weren't doing the right sort of thing. But it all worked out. Like they had, some farmers had land girls working for them, and they had perhaps 100 down the fen country picking potatoes and all that. And they wouldn't allow the prisoners to mix with the land girls. But there's no law said that they shouldn't. So they used to split the field in half, and the land girls used to pick that road on, and the prisoners used to pick that road on. And the owners were two brothers, the Miller brothers. So I went down to see them and I said, what's the idea of working on these prisoners like this? They said, oh, they're not allowed to mix with the civilians, English civilians. I said, who said so? I said, somewhere we've been told. I said, come off on it, mate. I said, there's no such law. When they're working, you can integrate them while they're working. I said, but they can't fraternise when they're not working. I really mixed them up. They were all right after that. So all these little things, the prisoners appreciated what I was doing for them, you see. And when I left just before they left, and they gave me a wonderful send-off. All 300 of them lined the Perry track where I had to drive down to come out. And they were all waving there, had their handkerchiefs out, made out, they were crying. Wonderful. In fact, I'm still in touch with them. I've got photographs of them. Even now.
Did you keep in touch with your old regiments as well?
No. When I quit, I quit. Because the 4th Hussars, you see, I wasn't actually interested in reunions or anything like that. I'd done my share. I wasn't really. And then Colonel Eve, when he got in touch with me down at Ashwell here, he was a big man for reunions. And he used to phone me up every year. Hey, come in with me. We're going up to the regimental reunion in London. No, thank you. I never went.
What about the Queen's Royal Irish? Did you stay in touch?
None of them. I never got in touch with any of them. I'd done my share.
Thinking back over your time in the military, you had one or two clashes with officers, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
What is it that you were looking for in an officer? What do you think are the qualities of a good officer?
Well, when I joined up, the officer fraternity, they weren't even military-minded. There was gay lot. Shooting, pheasant shooting, all that, cocktail parties. Didn't know a thing about military things. They left that all up to the NCOs, looks like me, to learn about it. And then they would criticise. They'd alter my decision, you see, and that didn't go down very well with me. And so I used to retaliate. Well, that's the worst thing you can do, really, is to retaliate against an officer. But it came automatic to me. If I knew what was right and what was wrong, I'd state it. So that's why I got in trouble with Randolph Churchill and quite a few more officers. I was always, not always at loggerheads, but I didn't accept their word when I knew they were wrong. It was like that. Because I'd had far more service, far more training, far more discipline than what they'd ever had. Because they weren't interested in the army before the war broke out. It was a gung-ho thing, you know. Army officers bought their own commissions. They were never promoted. They paid for their commissions. And it was one round of cocktail parties and shooting on these estates. I know, because I was a part of it. Then when the nitty-gritty come, and it was the war broke out, now they've got to come to us, haven't they? They had to do what we knew. They didn't know. I mean, this is commanding officer of mine whose life I saved. I've often wondered why I risked my life to save his. Because he was useless. Absolutely useless. He didn't know the first thing about soldiering. Oh, he knew all about cocktail parties and shooting. Even when we moved from England to, from Egypt to Greece, I packed 4 12-bore shotguns in my tank and about 2,000 cartridges. He didn't think about there was any war there. He was going shooting. Shooting in the mountains. Yeah. And then when I threw his rifle, his guns away, in emergency, I threw his guns and everything away, he went airless. He went mad. He wasn't bothered about me not having any ammunition for my gun. I'd thrown his 12-bore shotguns away, hadn't I? Well, actually, I hadn't thrown them away. I'd stored them with a Greek family. So I don't know what happened to him. I suppose we perhaps still got him. And then Churchill came on the scene, Randolph Churchill. And he made one or two suggestions to me which really annoyed me. I was taking a gun team out on, it was at Driffield in Yorkshire. And we just got the new Bren gun in. And it comprises of 27 different parts. Now anybody can fire a Bren gun. But could they strip one down if they had a fault in it in the middle of the night, in the darkness? So I had a thing going there where I used to take them in batches of perhaps 10 or 15 out on the fields in the park, blindfold them, and have them to strip the gun down and lay them out by memory, where all the bits were. Then assemble it by memory. Which they got very proficient at. They knew they could do it quite easy, weave a bit together again. Which you would have to in the dark, if you had a fault. And Randolph Churchill turned up one day and he stood watching me. And he said, I think you could be, you'd be better employed teaching them something else. I was a corporal then, Corporal Newman. I said, oh yeah, what? He said, about gas, mustard gas. I said, well, there's very little we know about mustard gas. I said, I know it was used in the First World War, because my father was gassed with it. I said, but there don't seem to be any facilities of training soldiers how to avoid, or what avoided action to take on mustard gas, you see. Oh, he said, I said, could you tell me? He said, oh, he said, I'll give you an instance. He said, you're out on the forward line with your troop of men. He said, and you come to a river. He said, it's too deep to wade through it. None of your men can swim. There's no means of building a raft. But you've got to get over the river. How would you do it? I made one or two mild suggestions. He said, ridiculous, ridiculous. I said, well, do you know a way we could do it? He said, yes. He said, roller skates. I said, what? He said, roller skates. I said, where do you get roller skates from? I said, they're not an army issue. I said, what are you going to do with roller skates in any case? He said, you roller skate across the bridge. I said, what about all the clouds of mustard gas you're turning up and going on roller skate? Oh, ridiculous, he said. But that is the answer. Yeah. And what I called him wasn't very pleasant. And the end result wasn't very pleasant. Well, can you imagine? Men like him, leading in the battle, as Captain Taylor. We were on standby for the invasion. Driffield. No, then Northampton, we were on the move. And we just had to stand by twice a night and during the day, all day. And it was late night and early morning. They used to come round and wake you up, you had to put all the equipment on and do a standby ready for in case the Germans had invaded in the night. Now we're in bell tents. And you have your own rifle, you've got your own number on it, on the boot, on the disc. But you're in a bell tent, and your rifles are stacked, well, seven or eight men to a...
Piled in the centre.
And they're piled in the centre. Mm. Now, you're supposed to know, according to this Captain Taylor, which is your rifle around that pole. You woke up in the middle of the night, half asleep, you've got to put your equipment on, no lights, not allowed any light, and you've got to get your own rifle. Unfortunately, this time I went on, I got the wrong rifle. Mm. But he had a little pencil torch and he checked the number, you see. And he put me on the charge for being in possession of another man's rifle. But then at the same time, there was another man who had also got the wrong
rifle.
Why it made any difference, I don't know, because all Royal Enfield rifles are the same, so it didn't make any difference. So I set up an argument with him. And he stood there in front of me, wafting this pencil light in front of my face, and he said, Newman, he said, I hope I never have to lead you into battle. I said, you must be joking, sir. He said, what do you mean? I said, you'll never lead me into battle. I said, I shall be leading you, but you'll be 10 miles behind me when I'm leading you. Now, he didn't like that. That was insubordination. It was everything, you know. Yeah. You see, they couldn't take the truth. I mean, another officer, a real military officer, He will also, well, that's a good answer, Newman. Mm. I've tried to catch you out on that one. But not these poxy fancy.
Did you meet any really good ones while you
yes.
were there? Yes. You did. What qualities did they have?
Well, they had the quality of being an officer, disciplinaire, but with brains. They knew what was right and they knew what was wrong. And Colonel Leave was one of them. Mm. I thought the world of him. I did. His wife's still alive and lives down in Ashwell. He was a man that he could see your point of view and he was willing to change his point of view to suit you if he thought you was right. But they're very rare. Mm. Very rare. The others just blunder along, bluffing themselves along, creating a problem. Don't know what they're doing. To the extent, I don't like, well, I won't mention names, but he's dead in any case, so I don't make any difference. Major Harrison, he threw a paddy. In other words, he lost his. Mm. Lost it. And I was carrying him in the tank just to keep him out of the way of anybody else's knowing about him, you see. And one day the radio went, and he was outside the tank. We was on a hold-up position, and I said to the radio operator, I said, "Who's that?" They said, "Oh, it's, they want Major Harrison." So I shouted to him. I said, "You want it on the radio?" I said, "It's pretty urgent." He said, "Answer it." I said, I can't. I said, I don't know most code, he said. "Well, hang up, don't bother with it." And it would happen to be the Colonel Leave. And as they closed the wireless down on him, he immediately come looking for me, for us. And I was out on the field, in the field where he come. Actually, I was getting some water from a tap in the field. He saw me and he come across with his tank. He said, "Newman," he said, "what's going on?" I said, "Why, sir?" He said, "Well, didn't Major Harrison answer my call?" I said, "Well, I told him, sir, but I said, he seemed to be a bit busy." He said, "Don't lie to me, Newman." I said, "Tell me the truth." I said, "Okay, if you want the truth, sir." "He's lost it." I said, "He just didn't know what he's doing." He said, "That's all I want to know." Yeah. And he had lost it. Completely.
What had caused that?
Well, in the first place, he should never have been a military man. Oh. And he was a mother's boy. Mm. I found this out afterwards. But he joined up, he had to join up, because they did do them days. They had to get into uniform, status symbol. Mm. You see? But he couldn't take military life, really. Mm. He couldn't. Not when the action took place, he'd had it. But after the war finished, he was the soldier again, wasn't he? Mm. And I'll tell you for why. When we came home, I didn't know where he was or what he was doing. And I there was an advert appeared in the Grantham Journal, advertising for Sergeant Newman, 553265, of the 4th Queen's Owners Arms. "Please contact Major Harrison on this telephone number." And it was a Welsh Cresseli number in Wales. Of course, we didn't have telephones then days, but I went to the call box and I phoned him up and I said, "Oh." He said, "Can you come over? The Cresseli." He said, "I'll pay your fare, pay all your expenses." I said, "Yes, I'll come over." And I thought, well, we'll have a reunion, you know. So I went to all the trouble of going over. And what he wanted to do, he wanted to give me a job for life, he said.